Our second case this morning is United States against McMahon. It's a certified case. Counsel for the government, you may proceed.
Thank you, sir. May it please the court, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
This case is not United States versus Jones. This is not a case where the greater offense and the lesser included offense had no elements in common. While the government realizes that it admitted, while not conceding error, and it admitted without conceding that the error was plain and obvious, that concession was probably a bit hasty and ill-advised. And it's worth probably having a conversation as to whether error occurred and whether it was plain error. Yet despite that, we realize that the certified issue is one of prejudice. Prejudice should be governed by the interest claimed to be affected by the error. Here, the claim is a due process notice error. Prejudice in that sense is viewed from the context of what the interest that the due process clause protects. And here, it protects the right of the accused to know what he was being defended against and protect him from further jeopardy if this situation ever arises again. Here, the accused had actual notice that he was being charged with the LIO of negligent homicide as well as the grid case.
Do I understand you to say in your brief that he could not be tried again or tried at all on the offense of negligent homicide?
Tried again, you mean if this court affirms his conviction?
Well, if negligent homicide is not an LIO of a voluntary manslaughter,
then he could be.
He can't, and this court determines that there's prejudice. Can he be tried on the offense of negligent homicide?
Yes, he can.
Okay, because your brief may assume that you win, so that he can't be retried, but or tried at all. But I just wanted to make sure I understood correctly that you weren't saying that that was barred in the event this court does not rule in your favor.
That is correct. If this court upholds the lower court's opinion overturning the conviction, he certainly can be tried for negligent homicide. Jeopardy has not attached.
Counsel, are you, in terms of the due process notice, are you addressing their error or are you addressing prejudice?
Well, the certified issue is regarding the prejudice, so I'm focusing my argument there. This court wishes.
No, I was just trying to make sure where you were going.
I'm certainly willing to do that.
Because you alluded in your opening remarks a little hesitancy about the certified issue, but my understanding it's we're focusing on the certified issue at this point.
That is correct. Obviously, this court reviews cases, not issues, so I'm certainly prepared to do both. Here, the accused received actual notice of the LIO in Bach. This court in Medina and in Miller understood that the right protected is the right not only to be informed but to be tried on a theory and to know what the theory is. And here, that is certainly the case. The government, the accused was notified as to the theory of the case, the LIO. Everybody understood that he was subject to the lesser included offense. And therefore, as both the federal circuits have held and some of the state courts that we have mentioned in our brief, actual notice would actually overcome an error. But certainly, actual notice will also overcome any prejudice that may arise from the error. The case of Galt versus Lewis, the Ninth Circuit case, is probably one of the best cases with an overall view to this notice error, whether or not we can look to things outside the record to provide notice, and then whether or not plain error analysis is appropriate, and then applying the plain error test.
So is it the government's view that the only interest that is protected by having being convicted of something that is actually on the charge sheet as opposed to something that comes up at trial is notice? That's the only interest?
The constitutional interest protected here is both the the interest protected by the Sixth Amendment is twofold, as this court has held in its variance jurisprudence in Finch and cases like that. So just on the constitutional concern, you're talking about, was he notified so that he can prepare a defense? That's the first aspect. And is he protected from double jeopardy? We understand in Jones there was another concern, and that was the statutory concern under Article 79.
Isn't there a constitutional right to have the government actually prove each element of the offense which you're convicted of beyond a reasonable doubt?
Sure, that was Russell versus United States, if memory serves. And
so if something's not an LIO of something, and even if you know it's out there, the government talks at trial the whole time about how you first snatched and the offense which you were charged with actually occurred at the time you were purse snatching, blah, blah, blah. But at no time are the elements of purse snatching ever presented to the trier of fact, and at no time does the government say, and this proves it was a purse, and this proves that Julio grabbed the purse, or perhaps you brought your own. Why isn't that a right to, don't you have a right to have to put the government to that test at trial? Rather than just at the end, everybody say, yeah, that was brought up, sure, that's purse snatching. Yeah, okay, that's good.
There's a difference between, we disagree. First of all, I would never carry a purse.
That's a question, so you disagree with the question? Or
no, we disagree with the characterization of the question. It's not that we just throw, it's not a cognitive evidence test to determine LIOs. That has been thrown out, and quite honestly,
To identify what constitutional rights are at issue.
Well, the right to notice.
So you don't think that Apprendi and all those cases like that, and the language about that every element of the offense has to be alleged in the indictment and proven to the jury beyond a reasonable doubt, you don't think any of that suggests that there is a constitutional right to actually be convicted only of those things that you're charged with?
Sure, there's a constitutional right. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, if it's not an LIO, by definition, it's not in the charge sheet, right?
If it's not an LIO, then it doesn't meet the charging test. However,
so it's not in the charge sheet. Colonel Puglio, you can say you don't. You can fight Jones and you can fight Miller and you can fight Medina to your heart's content. But the government didn't certify those cases, or they didn't appeal those cases to the Supreme Court, and that's the law.
Well, that is the law.
Don't fight me on the fact that if it's not an LIO, it's not in the charge sheet.
But this court, we're not fighting you on the fact that it may or may not be an LIO. What we're fighting you on the fact is that whether prejudice whether this court can attest for prejudice.
Well, that's a different question. That's a different question than whether there's a constitutional right convicted of what you're charged with.
He was responding to my question, though, which is what constitutional rights should we be testing for with respect to prejudice?
Let's have Colonel Puglio first address Judge Ryan's question and then address Judge Baker's question.
The prejudice question deals with the issue of the certified question deals with the question of prejudice and whether plain error can be applied to a due process notice violation. And the courts have consistently held, and this court has consistently held, and in Jones you consistently held, that you can apply plain error to a notice defect. This court did it in Jones. In footnote 11, after looking at the constitutional requirement, after looking at the statutory requirement, after all that, in footnote 11, this court tested for plain error. And it said there was prejudice in Jones because he was tried on a theory by which he was not notified of, and at the end of the trial, that's when they brought it up, and that constituted prejudice. Furthermore, Jones looked at the case and said, this is what's wrong with this case is it's a variance, and it's a fatal variance. This court has always tested variance for prejudice. And in Finch, in fact, when you're applying a variance test to determine whether or not it's fatal, you look to the constitutional requirements or the constitutional interests that are affected, and that is whether or not the accused was put on notice of the defect and whether or not he would be subject to jeopardy in the future.
Now, you've addressed the notice aspect of prejudice, but what about the due process right to have each element of an offense presented to the trier of fact and adjudicated beyond a reasonable doubt? Is that a separate constitutional right?
Well, it is assumed that is it a separate constitutional right? It is assumed in the notice provision because if, at, I guess yes and no. Yes in the sense that if you're not notified of the crime.
Let's do it this way. Let's create a hypothetical which will confuse everybody. So you have noticed everybody gets together with the judge in advance and will say, we all agree that this is, that notwithstanding the fact that this is not an LAO of the charged offense, we all agree that you are also being put on trial for dog kidnapping, or whatever silly thing I have. Everybody agrees. Any issue with notice? No. Thank you. I got it. I'm on trial here for that as well. We can litigate the Jones aspects of that later.
You haven't been charged with it.
You haven't been charged with it. But everybody agrees this is in play. In the course of trial, it never comes up again. But in the course of trial, there are facts that relate to it that are presented. But the trier of fact is never given the elements for that offense. And the trial counsel never gets up and says, as you see, element one has been met in this manner. As you see, element two has been met in that manner. Has there been a constitutional right violated in this case if at the end the judge comes back and says, well, you're guilty of that as well?
There was no instruction on the matter?
No instruction on it.
Well, then how? I don't understand how you can be found guilty of something that the finder of fact isn't instructed on. As this court said in Jones, there are a variety of ways. Given your situation, if I can just amend it just slightly, let's say everybody gets together for dog napping before the case. It's not on the charge sheet, but everybody agrees that dog napping is on the table. The trial goes through, dog napping, that's okay, and at the end, the judge instructs on it. Can he be convicted of dog napping? It seems that in Jones, you can be. All these alternate theories beyond the charge sheet seem to be allowed by Jones, even though it's not on the charge
sheet. What language in Jones are you fixating on for your reading? I mean, what specific, point me to the specific language in Jones that you're relying on.
Correct point, ma'am.
The one that you just made. That Jones stands for the broad proposition that so long as someone knows about something somehow that it's okay, she could be convicted of it.
If I could do that on rebuttal, I'll answer your question.
Until you can point me to that language, I would quit relying on that language because I'm a little bit familiar with the opinion and don't recall it at all.
I believe it stems from this court's opinion in Jones where it says nothing prevents the government from pleading an alternative theory. Also, nothing prevents the accused from standing up during the trial and amending the charge.
Allowing the amendment to the charge sheet.
Or the government standing up and agreeing with the parties that another charge, a quote-unquote LIO, which seemed to suggest wasn't an LIO, is now before the court. That's the way the government reads Jones, that somewhere in the trial itself, that the parties get together and agree that there's another charge before the court.
But
otherwise, if it's not charged, you can't be found guilty, and that provision of Jones doesn't seem to follow.
So if your argument is if the parties get together and agree that there's another charge out there, but never memorialize that, never amend it, that's valid?
Well, this court said so in Wilkins. When the accused agreed in the pretrial agreement to plead to a charge that wasn't an LIO, and the court found that was okay because it was an inferred referral, both parties agreed and went through, and it was fine. So, yes, this court has said in the past in Wilkins specifically, and theoretically in Jones, where the parties at some point can get together and say, oh, it's okay, we'll amend the charge sheet. Here, there seemed to be no problem if the accused or the government had gotten up at some point in the trial and said, hey, negligent homicide, we want to amend the charge sheet to refer 134.
Except all these things, I mean, I'll point you to the language in Jones that I assume that you're referring to, which is, nor is there anything to prevent the government with the accused's consent from amending the charge sheet. Finally, the accused is always free to plead guilty, not guilty to an offense's charge, but guilty of a named lesser included offense, or guilty with exceptions and substitutions to something that would make it a different offense. All those things involve changes to the charge sheet.
But then you have to read that in the context of Wilkins, where there was no change. Which there was no change in the charge sheet. The only thing put before the court in Wilkins was the pretrial agreement, which said, I'm going to plead to this offense.
Well, I can question whether Wilkins would still be viable. I mean, I'm looking at the RCM and what it requires, what Supreme Court precedent, what it requires, and our case law, what it requires. And all I'm suggesting, sir, is that the language that is in Jones isn't just some general, the parties sort of agree to something. It all involves a formalistic change to what is charged, the elements that are on the charge sheet that the government has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, or that the accused is agreeing to plead guilty to.
Well, if that were the case, then Jones footnote 11 clearly becomes an issue, because if the charge sheet in Jones had to be formally amended, and it wasn't, then the prejudice analysis, the plain error analysis there, just is a non sequitur, because if it was error, it was just error. Also, all the federal courts in the habeas proceedings, when dealing with the notice error, where the courts are not subject to a Fifth Amendment indictment clause issue, all those courts have applied the plain error analysis to that. So the plain error doesn't make sense if
you mean
it would
for an, do you mean for a constructive amendment to the indictment? You're saying that they all apply to plain error analysis?
No, but this court has never adopted the constructive amendment principle. And even in Jones, this court didn't say there was a constructive amendment. This court said there was a variance, a fatal variance. I don't know of no precedent where this court has adopted a constructive amendment constitutional concern. The constructive amendment constitutional concern for the federal courts implicate the Fifth Amendment indictment clause, not the Sixth Amendment due process clause. That's the problem. The court should be careful, or the party should be careful to ensure that we don't conflate the Fifth Amendment indictment clause, where there is a per se prejudice analysis because you haven't been indicted and you're required to be indicted on that thing, versus a variance clause. And this court has adopted, in Jones, a variance test. And the variance test focuses on prejudice. That's what Finch tells us. Finch tells us when we have a variance, we look to see if it's fatal to determine whether or not the constitutional rights of notice and jeopardy are put in harm. And if they are, then you have a variance, and the variance, as in Jones said, is fatal.
Counsel, your time has expired, but with the indulgence of my colleagues, I'll ask a question here on the subject of prejudice. With respect to prejudice, if you have a case in which, at the outset, the defense has made a strategic decision in a murder case that there's likely to be a conviction for something, and they decide that negligent homicide is their best refuge at that point, and they argue it in their opening statement, and in the examination and cross-examination of witnesses, evidence is brought out with respect to negligent homicide, then they request negligent homicide instruction at the end, but there's no amendment, constructive amendment, et cetera. Then I understand in that case the government's argument is that there's no prejudice under Jones. Whether there is or not, that would be the government's view. And in a case where the issue of negligent homicide does not come up until the instruction at the very end, then we have Jones and we don't have prejudice. Now, in the case that's before us, trying to figure out where the prejudice is. That is, as I read the record, we have a number of references to negligent homicide during the course of the trial, and I'm trying to determine whether any of them reflect an affirmative act on the part of the defense in which they would seek some advantage out of the negligent homicide such that they wouldn't be prejudiced in this case. I was having trouble finding that because this is a case in which the defense from the outset urged that there was no evidence in that regard, and they made several motions in there. And in light of those defense motions, how would we find no prejudice in this case?
Again, if the prejudice has to be defined by the interest sought to be protected, and the prejudice here, as in Strickland, and as in whatever the case it was, but as in Strickland, when the Supreme Court analyzed prejudice, they said the first thing you have to do when you analyze prejudice is identify the interest sought to be protected had the error not occurred. So if Your Honor is looking for where the prejudice is,
prejudice to the defense. Yeah.
The question seemed to be, number one, did he have notice of the negligent homicide as a theory of prosecution? And two, is he protected later on from jeopardy if the government decides to charge him again under this fact pattern? Just as in your variance jurisprudence, if you find he has had notice, therefore he's not prejudiced on the notice, he was not surprised or misled, and two, he's protected later on and he could raise a double jeopardy issue, therefore he is not prejudiced, and that's how you define prejudice. It's not whether or not he had an advantage. Rarely does, I guess, an accused have an advantage at trial. It's not seeking advantage, it's seeking what interest is involved and where those interests are.
Thank you, counsel. You have a further opportunity on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for the defense.
Chief Judge Efron, and may it please the court, I'm Captain Michael Berry, and I represent Fireman Justin McMurrin. There are two charges at issue in this case, one over which the court-martial had jurisdiction and one over which it did not. Fireman McMurrin was convicted for the latter, and the government wants to say that that's okay because Fireman McMurrin was not harmed by that conviction. But there's no way to assess the harm to a service member who's been convicted of an offense that he was never charged with. There are two reasons why the conviction for negligent homicide cannot and should not be subject to a plain error analysis. First, as mentioned, the trial court had no jurisdiction over the offense of negligent homicide.
Do we have to decide the jurisdictional question to decide this case?
No, Your Honor, but it is a threshold issue that should be addressed. That should be analyzed and addressed first.
We don't have to.
Well, if you're correct, there is no jurisdiction. Don't we have to decide that? At least whether you're correct.
Yeah, yes, Your Honor. It's a threshold issue, but even if the court decides jurisdiction, that there was jurisdiction, I guess my response is that you can still affirm the lower court's decision to set aside the conviction on other grounds. So the two reasons why it's not subject to plain error is that there's no jurisdiction, or there was no jurisdiction at the trial level, and two, Article
59. That's your 201 argument?
Yes, Your Honor. And two, Article 59B of the UCMJ would preclude any reviewing authority from affirming the conviction for negligent homicide.
But counsel, explain that argument.
The 59B argument, Your Honor? Article 59B says that any reviewing authority with the ability to affirm a conviction can instead affirm a conviction for a lesser included offense. Well, in this case, negligent homicide is decidedly not a lesser included offense of any charged offense. So under 59B, the reviewing court would have no authority to affirm that conviction.
Has that provision of the UCMJ ever been applied to a circumstance in which there was a conviction at trial, or has it only been applied to situations in which there has not been a conviction at trial, and now the appellate court is affirming a lesser included offense?
From my reading, Your Honor, that has been applied to the latter situation that Your Honor just described, that when the appellate court was the one that determined, perhaps on factual sufficiency grounds, that the original conviction could not stand, but then decided to affirm a lesser included offense. So I am asking the court to interpret Article 59B in that manner.
Thank you.
Well, would you just for the sake of argument, let's say that we disagree with you and believe that this issue is subject to plain error analysis. Can you please explain your view as to A, the constitutional rights that are implicated, and B, how your client was prejudiced?
Yes, Your Honor. The constitutional right would be Sixth Amendment due process, specifically notice, and the prejudice that would arise from that would, there's several elements of prejudice. First is the element of surprise or lack of preparation. Our system of military justice is not a system predicated on surprise. We encourage precision, consistency, predictability. To hold it as the government asks and go with this concept of actual notice, it becomes awfully messy. In this case, there was no Article 32 for negligent homicide.
So you're saying you were surprised in the context of this case that in a case where all the parties thought negligent homicide was an LAO, a voluntary manslaughter, this surprised you that the appellant? I'm getting to the prejudice piece, not the constitutional right piece.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, there's no way of determining from reading a record of trial the element of surprise, and that could have been a trial defense counsel strategy to not express any surprise, I can't speculate as to what or why a trial defense counsel may or may not say, I wasn't prepared for this, perhaps because he didn't want to embarrass himself in front of his client. But it's certainly clear that the notion of negligent homicide first arose, and it was interjected by the military judge at the 907 motion during oral argument when he asked, would the LIO survive this motion? And trial defense counsel said it would not. So that's the first time it arose, and notably, that was immediately prior to the final government witness. So at that point, we'd already had multiple key government witnesses who had already testified against the accused, one of whom had been dismissed, not subject to recall. So there was no opportunity to cross-examine those witnesses on the elements of negligent homicide prior to the dismissal, one of which, again, was not subject to recall. So that person, that witness was gone.
No subpoena power?
There is subpoena power, Your Honor, but again, that becomes, it's a logistical issue. It becomes, it's messy, is the best way to put it. And
is Article 46 subject to logistical considerations?
No, Your Honor. The court does have the subpoena, but that witness could have been subpoenaed back. But at the time of the trial, there's no evidence on the record that the defense was prepared to move forward on a theory of negligent homicide. And in fact, the record quite clearly indicates that involuntary manslaughter was really what this trial was about. It was about involuntary manslaughter. And so when those witnesses were dismissed and without the opportunity to cross-examine them, that's where this whole concept of actual notice becomes messy. At what point can we look at the record and say, oh, well, that's when the accused was on actual notice?
Well, let's try the two hypotheticals I gave to the government. The one in which the defense, in a case just like this, let's say the defense had decided from the outset in its opening statements, throughout all its questions, in a request for an instruction, he asked for negligent homicide to be considered throughout, but the charge sheet was never amended, etc. Would there be prejudice in that case?
Yes, Your Honor, because the charge sheet would that charge would have to be referred anew or referred.
Well, that goes to whether there was error, okay? If you don't mind, Chief Judge, let's imagine that your client was charged with unpremeditated murder, okay? And you came in, and your defense from the get-go was, no, these people died, but I didn't do it or cause it to be done, but I should have supervised my team better. I admit that. Okay, so there is some, you are admitting from the beginning, and your defense from the beginning is not greater of what the government is claiming, but lesser culpability. In that case, leaving aside the fact that it's not an LIO and it's not on the charge sheet, which goes to whether there's error, right? Admittedly, it goes to whether there's error. In that context, how could you say that you were prejudiced when that's your fallback defense from the very beginning, and that's the theory that you proceed on at trial?
And just to add that, not asking you to concede that in this case, but asking you if that was the presentation on the record, where would the prejudice be?
Yeah, just to be clear, I'm not suggesting that that is this case.
Well, in that case, Your Honor, the prejudice stemming from notice may be severely diminished, but that doesn't take away from the fact that we still haven't hit some of the RCM prerequisites, such as there was no impartial investigator that could look into that additional offense. That if this is in front of a GCM, that's a requirement. And so for that statutory requirement to not have been satisfied, I would argue that's prejudice.
Well, I would agree with you that all those constitutional and rule-based requirements wouldn't have been met. So we all agree that there's error, right? Perhaps constitutional error, but assuming that we disagree that this is structural error and that we do test for prejudice, which is the only thing that the footnote in Jones does suggest, where would be the prejudice in the situation that we've described to you? Which is a different question than whether that's your case. We're not suggesting it is. And it's a different question as to whether there was error at all.
Perhaps I realize I'm not attempting to conflate prejudice with error here, Your Honor, but perhaps it's just that the prejudice would be self-evident from conviction for an offense that one has not been charged with.
So that goes to your it's structural error, it's always error, you don't test for prejudice argument?
Yes, Your Honor. And that, again, likewise, the lack of the Article 32, the lack of referral of that particular charge would just loop back to the jurisdictional argument. Even though Jones never explicitly mentions jurisdiction, our position is that jurisdiction has its fingerprints all over the error in this case and likewise in Jones.
If we hold that there was no jurisdiction, do we open us up to coram nobis stretching back to 1951 for every LIO case?
No, Your Honor, because this case would fall within that very limited window, perhaps the only case that falls under Harcrow, which is the law of the case in appeal. I haven't seen very many cases that arise under this LIO area of law post-Jones, and because this perhaps is the only case that was on direct appeal at that time. So any case...
So you're saying Griffin v. Kentucky closed it off?
I'm not familiar with that.
Well, that's your retroactivity case. You know, cases that are under appellate consideration at the time, you apply the new rule. Cases that are gone, you don't.
Yes, Your Honor.
So we're proof against coram nobis, if we buy your theory?
With respect to all cases that were not on direct appeal at the time of Jones, yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
In Adams, this Court said that jurisdiction depends on a properly referred charge.
Yes, Your Honor.
Can you walk through why the charge in this case was properly referred or not?
The charge was not properly referred, Your Honor, because the Supreme Court in McClary v. Deming said that courts martial, which are Article I courts, are of special and limited jurisdiction. They only exist, they're only breathed into existence for a specific purpose, which is to address the offenses brought before them. In this case, the offense of negligent homicide was never brought before the court. Furthermore, there are several RCM prerequisites, the incremental steps that must be taken in order to have jurisdiction. RCM 405 and Article 32 of the UCMJ say that in order for a charge to be referred to a general court-martial, they have to be investigated by an impartial investigator.
We've held that 32 isn't jurisdictional, haven't we?
Yes, Your Honor.
The fact that a 32 was not held or a 32 was held improperly or the 32 didn't, we've held that not to be jurisdictional, haven't we?
Yes, sir. It's not a per se jurisdictional.
It's not a per se jurisdictional prerequisite.
So
the language I cited did not reference Article 32, or did it? Are you basing your argument that there's no jurisdiction because the charge was not properly referred based on the absence of an Article 32?
Well, that and the fact that it did not appear on the charge sheet, and that it did not appear, there was no convening authority that signed the referral block of the charge sheet saying that I have referred this charge. There was no pre-referral. There was no independent person to say I have looked into these charges and the matters set forth therein, and I attest that they are true and accurate to the best of my knowledge, and signing the referral block. None of those prerequisites for jurisdiction were satisfied with respect to negligent homicide.
If this case is reversed, can the appellant be put on trial for negligent homicide?
If this court reverses the lower court's decision, or if the conviction is reversed, if the conviction is set aside, yes, he may be retried for negligent homicide, or not retried, but may be tried for negligent homicide, Your Honor.
Counsel, just to make sure I understand the defense position here, am I correct that your position is that there was error in this case therefore a prejudice analysis does not apply, and furthermore, that you have no argument on the issue of prejudice because you're relying solely on the issue of error.
Yes and no, Your Honor.
I'll try one of those two answers, and we'll proceed from whichever one you decide that you want to rest on.
The error is not subject to the plain error analysis. However, as a contingent argument, Your Honor, if this court disagrees and decides that it is subject to a plain error analysis, then the argument is that the court should presume prejudice. Article 59A, which the government has cited, does not preclude reversal based on a presumption of prejudice. It merely precludes reversal in the absence of prejudice. And there are certain circumstances, limited circumstances, but there are circumstances where prejudice may be presumed. And this is one of those circumstances. In fact, the error in this case is more egregious than the typical circumstances in which
Is that a rebuttable presumption or a presumption that can't be rebutted?
Well, if it's presumed, then I don't know the answer to whether it can be rebutted, Your Honor.
Well, let's assume that it can be rebutted. What's your argument for the prejudice other than presumption of prejudice, which sounds to me like the same argument that it's error? Because if it can't be rebutted, then the error answers the question without any prejudice analysis.
Well, if it can be rebutted, then the government would bear the burden to prove that it was harmless. Any error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. In this case, it hasn't done so. The error here, or the prejudice here, excuse me, is the conviction itself, which again sounds like it's a self-evident
it does.
Prejudice.
Yeah.
And furthermore, it's the lack of preparation that was afforded to the defense.
But did not he have actual and legal notice at the time? Because the law was not changed until after the trial. So how can you argue he didn't have, you made an argument he did not have actual notice in some manner, but why didn't he have legal notice?
Point.
Albeit because the law was changed after the trial.
That's correct, Your Honor.
What is it he didn't have notice of?
He didn't have notice that he could be convicted for negligent homicide. And even if he had legal notice, it doesn't really matter because according to Jones, That's not an LIO. So any legal notice that any
legal notice would have to depend on the elements alone. So he did not have notice, even if he had notice.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the only argument you're making today that is not subject to let me try that again. You think there's structural error, but is that structural error the jurisdiction argument, or is that something else?
Actually, there's a separate argument for structural error that I did not get into, Your Honor. The structural error here, it's structural because it falls into that very, very narrow category of errors that was identified in Chapman and Fulminante. It's something that affects the framework of the trial, it wasn't just an error that occurred during the presentation of evidence or within the trial itself. This is something so fundamental to our notion of military justice that an accused service member would be convicted for an offense that he wasn't charged with. This offends the basic notions of due process to the point where there's really no other category we can put it in, and therefore we should put it on, this court should identify it as structural error. Now, again, as pointed out, as mentioned earlier, we don't have to go that far because jurisdiction would be the threshold analysis. And this court can and should decide that there was no jurisdiction, and that ends the analysis right there. If there's no jurisdiction, obviously, then the charge goes away. And Chief Judge Efron, to get back to your question about the prejudice, again, it was the lack of preparation on the part of the defense to defend against negligent homicide. Negligent homicide was not the theory of the case, and the first time it was interjected was mid-trial, immediately before.
Now you're arguing now actual notice, not legal notice, to get back to Judge Baker. It sounds like that's what you're arguing now.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And arguing that actual notice should not be the standard, but if that is the direction, the approach that we're going to take, then there wasn't actual notice either. But actual notice is insufficient for military justice. It's
well,
messy.
If we go on prejudice, is it enough to constitute prejudice, you know, leaving aside structural error? Is it enough to constitute prejudice?
Is the lack of actual notice?
Yeah, the actual notice question you raised.
Yes, Your Honor, it's enough to constitute prejudice because, again, you can, an accused can't, I mean, if all the parties were to somehow agree that there is this extra charge.
There's no indication of IAC here, is there?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
There's not. And okay. Again, and if this was a member's trial, this was military judicial, but if it was a member's trial, then at what point would we be able to know that the members were sufficiently notified of what the accused was charged with and to be convicted of, if we're to use this notion of actual notice? So, I see that I'm running out of time.
Counsel, we gave the government some additional time, and that's not, I'm not offering you to go on forever, but if you do have another point you want to make and then conclude, you'll have the time to do that.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll just briefly conclude that, again, in this case, there were two charges at issue, one over which the court-martial had jurisdiction, one over which it did not. To convict him of the offense that the court-martial didn't have jurisdiction over is error and prejudice. It's jurisdictional. And for the government to say that, well, it doesn't matter because he had what appears to be a fair trial is not good enough. And therefore, this court should affirm the decision of the lower court and set aside the conviction for negligent homicide.
Thank you, counsel. Does the government have a rebuttal?
Yes, sir. Getting to the question of retroactivity and whether or not subject to quorum nobis requirements, the government believes that the proper test is Teague because it's a post-trial, post-conviction, post-finality retroactivity analysis. Teague Supreme Court test. There was one case that I found that this court held in Nixon, 5MJ at 236, which dealt with a jurisdictional question and the retroactivity of a jurisdictional question. I don't know if that would survive the Supreme Court's analysis in Teague. And Teague said if there's a watershed procedural rule, then it applies. Or if there's a substantive rule in which the crime wasn't a crime at all, then that applies too. Barring those two, they don't apply. If this court holds that it's structural, that would probably implicate all those cases. Because if we accept what defense counsel said, that there's no due process notice here, then every case since 1950 it is subject to that same argument, that there was no due process notice when the accused either pled guilty to the LIO, that was a listed LIO and didn't meet the strict elements test, or was convicted of the LIO that wasn't a strict element. If it's really a due process argument, and if it really fails on due process grounds, then that would implicate, it might implicate Teague. I haven't done fully researched on that, but that's a consideration.
A consideration, just to be clear, Colonel Puglio, consideration for what?
For whether or not retroactivity would apply.
And that's a consideration for?
Just the retroactivity analysis, whether or not, Judge Stuckey asked the question whether
and
or not.
I guess my question is, are you making that argument as a reason that we should or should not?
No. I'm just answering the judge's question. But no, this should stay
so
in
the government wants to make the argument that this would be basically a Teague issue? It wouldn't be Teague barred?
I don't know. I was just asking the judge's question. The retroactivity is not before this court. I don't think this court should take retroactivity into account for this. I'm just following up on the question asked by the judge. Quickly, as this court knows, in Puckett versus United States, conviction itself cannot be prejudice. It begs the question whether there was actual notice. There certainly was actual notice.
Well, counsel, you'd agree, based on Harcrow, that we use the law as it applies now and we pretend that it was the law then to determine whether there was notice or not, right?
Right, yes.
So under that test, there wasn't notice it was an LIO by the fact that he was charged with something different.
I agree that Jones applies to this case and all cases that are still on direct review. The question I was addressing was after direct review, after finality, after 76 finality, and you have a petition for extraordinary writ, what's the retroactivity laws that apply under those circumstances? So that's all I was saying.
Oh, I thought that you were talking about notice and saying that he had actual notice that this was an LIO by virtue of the fact that he was charged with something different when we apply the law as it is now. He wasn't, in fact, on notice based on Hargrove, which is a little bit of a mind-bending concept, I agree, but it is the law.
Well, if I may sort of just answer the judge's question, in the plain error analysis, it has to be plain, and plain means that it wasn't subject to debate at the time of the trial.
No.
Well,
look at Hargrove. I'd suggest that you read Hargrove.
Well, ma'am, I'm just getting this from United States versus Marcus, the Supreme Court test applying the prejudice analysis. So I agree with you that
I agree that it would be plain at the time of trial, but under other Supreme Court precedent, when you're looking at a case that's on direct review, in the case that the law has changed between the time of trial and the time of appeal, you apply the law at the time of appeal and go through the legal fiction that it was the law at the time.
A violent agreement.
Okay.
Violent agreement.
So good.
But when you look at is that a word for it? But yes, you're absolutely right. So if I just may briefly, sir, if this is a due process claim, we look to the interest protected by due process, and here actual notice. If we're going to apply Schmuck strictly, we should apply the federal analog to Schmuck and the federal precedent of Schmuck and test this for prejudice.
Can I ask one question, Colonel Pulido? Do you agree that the situation I asked the defendant's counsel about before, where at the time that he's, and it's not this case, but the person is charged with premeditated or unpremeditated murder, and that they come in from the beginning and the defense is, no, it was negligent homicide because I didn't properly supervise my team. Would you agree that case has a lesser claim to prejudice in this case?
I think if going with the Chief Judge's question, if there's a noticeable benefit on the record, and that's it might even be invited error. I mean, it might even be an invited error. So it might may transcend the prejudice analysis to be invited error in that case. And here we're not saying it's invited error, but I think the prejudice is prejudice. You got to look at the interest protected and whether or not it's compromised.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for your presentation today. This case is submitted, and the court will stand in recess.
The court stands in recess.